Plato thought there were three parts to the human soul: the thinking part, the feeling part, and then the part that he calls the thymos. That's the part of us that needs to be seen and noticed, and our need to be esteemed as a person. But sometimes our thymos can get us into embarrassing situations. When we get competitive and it backfires on us. There's this very famous American sports agent, and he tells a story of having a business lunch with this Australian TV executive. Now, this executive works for a very famous man, someone who owns a global media empire. You can guess who that is. Now, this man is so famous that when he takes people out for a meal, at the end of the meal, he just walks out of the restaurant. Now, he could be showing off, or he just couldn't be bothered with something like as mundane as like credit cards and pushing buttons on that thing that they give you. But because he's so famous and so recognizable that the restaurant simply would just put the bill on his tab. So for whatever reason, probably to be impressive, his employee, this TV executive, decides to try the same thing. Just walk out of the restaurant with the agent, that lunch with the agent, the way his boss does. He barely took a few steps to the door before he got chased down by the waiters, reminding him that he hadn't paid. So instead of being impressive, he ended up embarrassing himself. Now, this is, I think, the kind of thing Jesus is talking about in our story today in Luke 14. He got invited to a dinner party. It was a Sabbath day meal, so the day of the Jewish week when the law says no work should be done. It's a day for rest and play and spend time with family and friends. And when Jesus sees the politicians working the room, trying to jockey for the more important seats, trying to outdo each other, Jesus decided to say something about it to his disciples. Now, I don't know if you ever done something like this to try to impress somebody and then fall flat on your face like that executive. I have. When I was a teenager, I spent one summer working at the community center in the West End. A man at the church owned a restaurant there, and he also ran the snack bar at the skating rink. So I mostly worked at the restaurant, and one of my church friends worked at the snack bar, but sometimes we would swap jobs. So we got to know the staff at the ice rink, and they would invite us to join them when they have after-hours skating parties and that sort of thing. Now, you know how when you go skating, and before they let you on the ice, when it's the time or whatever, you would see the staff on the ice skating around before they let other people in, right? So there was a day when my brother and his friends came skating, and I decided to seize the opportunity to show how special I am. So as they were waiting for the gates to open, I and the staff were just skating around, I decided to jump on the ice. Disaster. They started yelling at me to get off the ice, and they chased after me. So as my brother and his friends were skating, I was getting scolded in the back room. My thymus got me into trouble. Now, I don't remember if they banned me from the rink, but I don't remember going skating after that for that whole summer because I was probably too embarrassed to show my face. And as much as I'd like to say that was the last time something like that ever happened, it wasn't. My thymus still needs what it needs. And maybe I have learned to be a little more aware of it and a little more honest and careful about it. Today is the 12th Sunday after Pentecost. This is the extended season after Christmas and Easter when we're thinking about how to live out Jesus' value system and his way of life and to learn to care about the things that he cares about. We do this with the help of the Holy Spirit, who is our companion, like a resourceful roommate, our coach, nudging us and encouraging us towards our goal of becoming like Jesus. Now, the Bible talks about wisdom more than anything else. Jewish wisdom is not just knowledge in our heads, but how to intelligently apply what we know, what we believe in, into actions that make a difference to ourselves and our relationships. So the Holy Spirit coaches us to become wise, to help us to grapple so that the words and teachings of the Bible would actually become something that we do in situations when pastors call when the rubber meets the road. That is how to be wise when it counts. So we have a prayer, I hope, that we can pray together. Awesome. Let's pray that. Inviting God, laying open our table to those without status or power, and setting a place for the foreign and the unwanted, overturn our tables of power and teach us to receive bread from strange and wounded hands. Through Jesus Christ, the one given for all. Amen. Now, the dinner party Jesus was at was hosted by this prominent Pharisee. The Pharisees were one of the factions on the Jewish High Council. They were the new party, the minority party, not like their colleagues, the Sadducees, who came from priestly families. So they were the old guards with the old money. So one of the things the Pharisees were obsessed about was how to make their old religion relevant in their time. So they were always questioning the old ways, the old rituals, and that's how they got the name, the noisy ones. The people who are always squawking, asking the questions, and always looking for an argument. But to be fair, this thing they're doing at the dinner to get ahead, it's a matter of survival for them because they live in empire. And in empire, power and influence is crucial. And to get that, they need to know the right people and to be noticed. And of course, they must seize every opportunity to advance their social and political standing. And that's why they could never let their guard down, not even at a dinner party, on the Sabbath. Now, it's not clear to me what to do with what Jesus says at a dinner party. So he points out to his disciples that competing for the good seats is actually a dangerous strategy that can backfire. Because there's a chance the host might come and ask you to move off the good seat so someone more important than you can sit there, and now you find yourself doing a walk of shame to the cheap seats in front of the whole room. Is that guy being chased down by the waiters? So that is certainly a good note about being overly eager that could end up being publicly embarrassing. But then Jesus adds this tidbit. If you really want the spotlight, go sit in the worst seat of the house. Because when the host sees you there, he'll be horrified and embarrassed that he is disrespecting a guest. So now, in front of everybody, he will come over to you at the cheap seat and escort you to the good seat. Then you'll be noticed in front of the whole room, and you'll be pampered for the rest of the evening. So this part is puzzling to me. Why is Jesus giving the Pharisees advice on how to be Pharisees? And why would Jesus care if the Pharisees or his disciples get that kind of notice in society? Now, Jesus does say somewhere that the way to get God's attention is not competing for the spotlight, but through humble service of other people, because that's what God notices. And that's the kind of life that gets rewarded in heaven. So maybe Jesus is just using this situation to reinforce that lesson with his disciples. Or maybe this is really what Luke is doing. Luke is writing his gospel to some non-Jewish person, probably high up in the empire, and he's reporting this Jesus story as a way to say, see, Jesus was not interesting in power. His teaching and his followers are not a threat to the empire. Or personally, I think, Jesus is being funny, and the wit is lost in translation. Maybe Jesus is poking fun at the way the Pharisees turned everything into a contest. For people who obsess over how to make their faith matter, they're completely missing the boat. It's a Sabbath rest meal. They're missing the rest, and maybe the meal. And there's something else they're forgetting. What Jesus says is actually a loose reference to something from the Proverbs, their holy wisdom book in the Bible. So maybe Jesus, in a funny way, is pointing out the gap between their Bible knowledge and their actual life. There's a funny Canadian who wrote a book on Canadian humor, and he defines humor as the gap between what we set out to do and what actually happens. So it's funny if we can laugh about it. The Pharisees set out to be relevant, and they end up missing the boat because they fail to translate what they know into how they live. They fail to be wise, and Jesus is pointing out the comedy. What the Bible calls wisdom is how to translate what we know into how we live. Proverbs is called a wisdom book, and the Bible talks about wisdom and wise living more than any other topic. That God expects us to learn to be wise, that is, to do our own thinking, instead of just handing us a list of do's and don'ts. So King Solomon was the original wise man, wise because maybe he didn't have the battle skills of his dad, King David. So he actually had to lead the country by solving problems with his head and diplomacy. So he collected good ideas from all over the world and he wrote them down as a sort of manual for people who help run the kingdom. This is where the thing Jesus says at the dinner party comes from, one of Solomon's wise sayings in Proverbs 25. The message says this: don't work yourself into the spotlight, don't push your way into the place of prominence. It's better to be promoted to a place of honor than face humiliation by being demoted. Now, it's not hard to imagine why this is in the employee's handbook for Solomon's court officials and servants. This is the king saying to his staff, don't overstep your station. Be careful about being overly eager and ambitious because you might annoy the king. Instead, work hard, wait to be noticed, and I will promote you accordingly. Now, of course, it's not immediately obvious how this piece of wisdom might apply at dinner parties. So what we see Jesus doing is the wisdom thing. He takes this Solomon's court rule from 700 years earlier, and he thinks about how it might apply in his situation, and he turns it into wisdom that is useful for politicians at a dinner party. Now, I don't know what your life is like, what kind of situations your thymos might act up and tempt you to overstep your station. So all I can recommend for you is to tuck this back into your head, so the next time your thymos feels neglected and needs attention and wants to show off or drag you into a contest to boost your ego at some situation, you might recall this bit of teaching and do the wisdom thing and think of a better way to get what you need, maybe a more humble way, because that's sort of more like what Jesus would do. Because as much as Jesus tells us to be wise, the Bible doesn't really say how. For all the situations that we might find ourselves in the 21st century. So this is where we need the Spirit's help. Dallas Willard says Jesus teaches you to live your life the way he would live your life. Wisdom is turning what we know into how we live, especially if we're to accomplish the mission that Jesus gives us, to love people into his kingdom. And to be effective at this, we really need to be good at relationships. One of my lawyer's friends, who was waiting to be made partner, once explained to me that the partners of a law firm all have a strength, a specialty, because like they need different people who are knowledgeable about each area of law. But the big money is for the partners who can make and keep friends, because they bring in clients and business. So the ability to make friends of strangers is the key to success in life, whether it's work, or solving problems in our apartment building, or being faithful to a mission as God's people, left in the world to make disciples. It's all about how we carry relationships, starting with the first handshake. And you probably know by now that there's nothing straightforward about relationships. One of my friends used to call me up with some regularity to say something like, I just had lunch with somebody, and at some point of the conversation, they started to get mad at me. I don't know why. And then we would spend the next hour on the phone doing a post-mortem of that conversation to try and see what happened. So this is how we learn and practice relational wisdom. We find friends whom we can be students together, and we seek out people and books from people who are experienced. Because as much as the Bible contains all the information we need to reestablish relationship with God, it's not enough, can I say that, to navigate modern life. And J.I. Packer, the theologian, used to say, all wisdom is God's wisdom. You know, we can't learn calculus from the Bible. So God gave us calculus from somewhere else in his creation. We will need to consult with otherwise resources who might have useful things to teach us about how to take care of our health, our money, and above all, our mental health and our relationships. They used to call this street smarts. The new name for relational wisdom is EQ. It's emotional intelligence that we need in relationships. So IQ is knowing a lot of stuff. EQ is knowing when and how to use what we know. And honestly, doing calculus is a lot easier than knowing what to do in challenging relationships. So Larry Crabb, the psychologist, says nothing makes us feel more inadequate than our problems from relationships. And for my master's degree in biomedical engineering, I had to do two hospital internships. So the first one was at the Children's Hospital, and it went very smoothly, partly because Children's had a very cheerful culture as far as hospitals go, and partly because all the people there in the engineering department really took care of me. They planned out things for me to do that would be good learning, and even when I made mistakes, they were very kind and patient and never got mad at me. And then I went to the second hospital, and it was like stepping into the Twilight Zone. So from the first day, the only engineer there acted like he hated me. In this place, the engineer had an office by himself, down the hall and around the corner from the office where the secretary sits. My desk was in the room with the secretary, and then all the technicians were in the basement. The engineer, after he showed me to my desk, never came back to talk to me or tell me what I should be doing. He just went back to his office and disappeared. So naturally, me being me and not knowing what to do, I just sort of started to chat it up with the secretary, and I went down to the basement to get to know the technicians. And of course, we got friendly, and they would invite me to have lunch with them and that sort of thing. But all the while, the engineer just got colder and colder, and I was confused. I didn't know what I was doing wrong. And I was concerned because this man had the power to keep me from getting my degree. I needed wisdom badly, but there was really nobody to ask about this. So I prayed, and I prayed for wisdom, and something like wisdom came into my head, and I decided to try something. So I came to work on the Monday, and I went to the engineer's office, and I said, do you have time today for a little meeting, say at 10? And he said, sure, come by at 10. So at 10, I showed up with a clipboard and a couple of files that I got from talking to the technicians, and I proceeded to give him a summary of what I've been doing, whom I've been talking to, and getting to know, and suggested a couple of projects for myself. Right away, he seemed happier. And then he gave me some comments, which I wrote down in front of him like I was hearing some really important stuff. And then I said, how about I come back next Monday at 10 and update you with my progress? And he said, fine. Now, back then, I didn't have enough EQ to know what was going on. I just did what they call a Hail Mary in football, trying something to see if it works. Now, having done some work to up my EQ, I think I can now look back with some distance to explain that place. Mostly, this thing wasn't about me. It was about things going on with the people in this place long before I got there. See, this apartment had sides. There were the technicians in the basement, and the secretary was Switzerland, and then there was the engineer on the side by himself. And the upstairs and downstairs sides almost had no relationship, except for the occasions when the engineer gave some direction and instructions to the techs, and the techs would report from the bottom. They didn't even seem to like each other. My guess is whenever an intern shows up, the two sides are watching to see which side the intern takes. That's what they were doing at the dinner party with Jesus. They were watching Jesus to see which sides he sidles up to. So when I asked for the meeting, I made him feel like I was treating him like my boss. And more than that, he felt like I was coming on side with him, and that made him happy. Now, since we were the only two engineers in the whole place, we were naturally on the same team, so to speak. We were doing work very different than what the technicians were doing downstairs. And since he was the boss engineer, I was waiting for him to tell me what to work on, to treat me like a staff. But he didn't do that, either because he didn't know how to, or it was a pride thing, or he just wasn't very good with relationships as a leader. And just because I was on the engineering side of things, it shouldn't mean that I couldn't also be friendly with the technicians, since we actually all worked together. It's just that they did the more hands-on things. But that was a dysfunction of this place, that somewhere along the way, the relationship took a wrong turn. When I took the initiative to ask for a meeting, I was doing what MBA school calls upward management. That's when your boss doesn't know what to do, and you have to be the boss of your boss so you don't get fired. So after my meeting, about two more meetings, our relationship changed. It worked so well, we didn't need any more meetings. And he didn't seem to mind as much that I was friends with all the technicians, because I wanted to have a different relationship with everyone than what was there before. So I survived my internship, I got my degree, but I never got a glowing evaluation from this guy. In fact, he wrote something very puzzling. He said, "Nick was hard to read." I had a hard time figuring out what he was thinking. That made me chuckle. I thought, in his eyes, of course, I was the one with the problem. Now, that sports agent wrote a book called What They Don't Teach You at Harvard Business School. And it's all about wisdom for navigating these sort of complicated relationships with complicated people. It's things that no school can teach you. So one advice he gives is to watch carefully, listen carefully, and talk less when we meet someone. So we know what people are comfortable with and what boundaries they'll never cross. This is empathy, to put ourselves in someone else's shoes to get their view of the world, and it's what people need from us before they will trust us. And the first step to empathizing, he says, is to learn to do two things at one time when we're with someone. So on the one hand, we're with someone in the moment, we listen, we talk, we do whatever we do, like having lunch or something. But at the same time, he says, to practice also standing like 4 feet away and watch the conversation and take notes. This is how we can better understand the dynamics of the relationship. How the other person is reacting to us, what we do and say, and how we are reacting to them. So I think this is what happened when I prayed for wisdom. The Spirit showed me how things looked from a few feet away, from my emotions. So the other day I took my car in for service. It has to be one of my least favorite things to do in life. The service guy who did the intake was clearly having a bad day at 7:30 in the morning. Apparently, two of the four people on his team called him sick, and he was not looking forward to the day. He started with that, telling me that. And then he went on to gripe about how his boss is giving him more responsibilities than he's comfortable with. And I wanted to, he says, I just want him to tell me what to do. I don't want to have to make decisions and then get blamed for it, he says. Now, my first impression as an impatient old man is that, you know, my inside voice wanted to tell him, young man, you should be more ambitious with your job. And it's bad form to air dirty laundry with customers. But then the me 4 feet away instructed me to keep my mouth shut, to watch, listen, and show some empathy. So I try on my face to show that I feel his pain. I asked him this and that to show that I'm paying attention. And I left him the key and I went to sit in the waiting room. Now, funny thing happened when the car was ready. As he's sort of doing the paperwork, he says, oh, I never asked you what you did, which is usually when the conversation gets interesting. So I said, I had been an engineer, but now I went to work as a pastor in the church. Oh, he says with some intrigue, were you brought up in a Christian home? What made you make that change? So I gave him like a short version of that story. So then I asked him, what about you? He said, well, my mom is Buddhist, but I'm not religious. Then he said, what do you think about Buddhism? Well, I took that as my invitation to talk about different world religions and why Christianity is the only source of information about our Creator. So I said to him, if you believe in a Creator, then when you become interested in what he's like, just ask him to show you. You know, I don't think I've ever seen this kind of curiosity from younger people, especially this openness to God at this moment. I think there's a whole generation of people that have a neglected thymos. They don't have anyone to talk to about it and to ask their life questions. And we can be that person if we have the wisdom to be a safe, approachable ally. And if we approach every interaction with strangers, asking the Spirit to connect our souls as human beings, and to let the Spirit make that encounter into what the other person needs, if we're willing to let them have our spotlight for a moment. My cousin was on a flight recently. There was a moment when he really needed to use the bathroom. But the flight attendants were serving dinner or something and blocking the way. So he saw behind him, behind some curtains, was this other bathroom. But before he could get in, they told him that was for business class. So then he asked them if they would let him pass to get to the washroom. But this one attendant said, oh, you have to wait. At this point, my cousin was getting upset. So in his head, he was planning to take names and file a complaint. But then later, this flight attendant came and tried to offer him a business class pastry, maybe as a kind of a wordless apology. And he started to say, oh, they had their hands full because there were a couple of sick kids in the back of the plane and some other passenger had an issue. Now, if this was us in my cousin's shoes, what would we focus on? Our own discomfort and bad experience, and say, why does this, any of this have to do with me? Not being treated well. Or would we try to empathize with the flight attendant having a bad day? This is the wisdom challenge for us as Christians. I'm not always successful at making it not about me, especially with people I know well. But then I think those relationships have more give and take. But God can bless anyone anywhere, even at unlikely places like the service counter in a car dealership or a crowded long-haul flight. We can be useful to God if we're practiced at offering empathy and if we're willing to be generous and forgiving. Because one of the most unwise things to do, I think, is to burn an entire relational bridge over a small thing. to choose to let off steam instead of keeping our cool. And it takes wisdom to know when to make our displeasure known and how to do it in a constructive way. My first job was in this Chinese church. I was the pastor of the English-speaking people. And one of the first things I wanted to do was to be allowed to have our own baptism services. Instead of being part of the one for the whole church, which can be really long with many people getting baptized, and so a bit impersonal because each person doesn't have much time to tell their stories. And sometimes very frustrating because people were speaking Chinese without any translations. So we were over the moon when they said we could do our own, we just have to learn to do all the setup, like filling the tank. So this one Friday night, after fellowship, we were filling the tank. But then disaster happened. These bunch of little kids from the Chinese-speaking congregation were chasing each other around the church, and they found their way upstairs to the sanctuary and to the back of the baptistry, and one of the boys fell in and got wet. As you can imagine, there was initially major panic, and then, of course, they wanted to know who was to blame. Now, honestly, none of us could have foreseen the need to pose armed guards. And there wasn't much water. But as we post-mortem the whole thing, I realized there was a much bigger thing at stake than whether it was really our fault. It was our credibility as a congregation to make our own decisions and to show that we can lead ourselves. So I said to our leaders, look, even though it's not really our fault, but if we don't want to continue to be treated like kids, I don't see any way out except to accept responsibility and publicly apologize for being not more careful. So that Sunday, all the deacons from the English-speaking congregation and me stood before the entire Chinese congregation and took one for the team. We ate crow and promised to do better. We decided to do the wise thing, to lose the war, however unfair, but to stay in the battle for the long haul. You know, when I finally left that job, I had a Chinese pastor ask me how I managed to stay in that church for so long, because these were very complicated systems to work in. Well, it's the thing they don't teach you in seminary. How to hold relationship when it is most mysterious and challenging. And offering people empathy and being generous and forgiving goes a long way in overcoming challenges with people. It's what the Bible calls wisdom, what the world calls EQ, something we can learn and practice, and is what the Spirit helps us with. So we can bless the people, even the ones hard to bless. So God help us to become wise, especially in this particularly triggering time. Christians don't have it easier in this life than anyone else, but we do have a mission that God gave us, to spread blessing and good news, and to be faithful to that, we have to find a way to rise above things that derail us from that. So regardless of our circumstances, God can use us to bless people into his kingdom, to offer a safe anchor for thymosis, feeling adrift and invisible, a community where they are seen and heard and appreciated. Let me read you a blessing a blessing for when you realize everyone is struggling. Blessed are you who have realized that life is hard. It's hard for everyone. Your awareness came at a cost. You lost something you can't get back. You are diagnosed with chronic pain or degenerative disease. Your family fell apart and things have never been the same. Blessed are you who gave up the myth that the good life is one of happiness, success, perfection. The life that looks beautiful on Facebook but is not real. You who realize it is okay to not be okay, to not have a shiny life because no one does. Blessed are you who sees things clearly, where struggle is everyone's normal. You walk among the fellowship of the afflicted, a club no one wants to join. And while this life isn't shiny, it does come with superpowers. Superpowers of ever-widening empathy and existential courage that get you back up after another fall. And a deepened awe at the beauty and love that can be found amid life's rubble, like flowers that grow from the cracks in the sidewalk. These virtues blossom in you, and thank God for you. Blessed are all of us who struggle, for we are in good company and will never walk alone. Amen.